Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
This is a Washington Post Live podcast from the Global Women's Summit with presenting sponsors AARP, Boston Consulting Group, and Volvo.
You're listening to Conversations from Washington Post Live's 2022 Global Women's Summit, featuring leaders and trailblazers from around the world.
Sev Gill, so President Zelensky said yesterday that the capture of Kherson is the beginning of the end of the war. So you're the editor of Ukraine's most influential daily news site. From your reporters on the ground, from your information, how do you see that? Do you think he's right?
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for having me. And thank you for your support, because without it, all our victories will be not possible. And we feel it. And today, Olena Zelenska said it. And I can just say that it's absolutely true. Without your support, without weapons, without everything that people provide us, it will be not possible. After the liberation of Kherson, personally, me, I'm from Crimea, I dream about that next time I will receive some news about liberation of Simferopol or my native Kerch. And we do believe in that. We believe that we will win this war in that. But sitting even now on the stage, I'm reading the news that right now Russia hit residential buildings in Ukraine. Hit already three residential buildings right now. It's happening right now. Of course, this victory will be difficult. This victory will be not very soon, but we believe that we have this struggle, we have this passion, and we actually don't have a chance to lose this war, because this is worse. This is war to the right of our country to exist.
To survive.
To survive.
Yes, to survive. So when you took over this job in 2014, two of your predecessors had been killed in the line of duty. I mean, the co-founder mm-hmm. was found beheaded. Mm-hmm. A reporter was killed in a car bombing. I mean, you actually worked before as a business reporter. I'm just, you know, frankly, in awe of why you took this leap into danger to edit this news site at a time of such conflict.
Yes, the co-founder of Ukrainska Pravda, Georgi Gongadze, was killed in 2000, and I was just 13 years old. I grew up in the southernmost region of Ukraine, Crimea, and this story is itching in my heart that the truth is a weapon, because, this story was a huge impact of this story in Ukraine and just for freedom of speech in our country and in trust for the journalist. And it led to accusations to the government and to the protest, ended with revolution, first revolution, Orange Revolution, and I was already 17 years old and I took part in this revolution because it was struggle of Ukrainian people for freedom, democracy, and Ukrainska Pravda played an important role just to move forward freedom of press as an essential value of our country.
I know, but you're so young and it must be so frightening, frankly.
You know, after Crimea was occupied, my heart was so broken. I understood that I can't follow business news anymore. It's not about that. I need to help my country and people in Crimea as well. And I understood that maybe Ukrainska Pravda will be also the way how I can do that.
Yeah. Well, Janine, you and I have known each other a long time. You are a very celebrated war reporter in many theatres of war. But now you're an activist, actually, you know, training to collect war crimes evidence in the midst of this conflict. So what compelled you to turn away from the telling of stories to sort of documenting evidence? That's a different role.
Yes, it is. First of all, thank you everyone for coming out this morning. Thank you, Tina and Sally and Sev Gill and Heidi. Such an honor to be with such amazing women. And being with people like you gives me energy and gives me strength to keep doing this kind of work. So the Reckoning Project was founded on February 25th, the day after the invasion. And it basically was born out of my extreme sorrow and bitterness at having witnessed three genocides in my life: Srebrenica, Rwanda, and the slaughter of the Yazidi people. I didn't want to see a fourth. And more than that, I've spent basically more than 35 years as a war reporter, but mainly focused on human rights and on war crimes. And I have seen too many bad guys get away with it and never get anywhere near The Hague, let alone get indicted or even outed in their own countries. And I've sat with too many women that have been raped or violated. I always think of women in Bosnia that were held in rape camps, 20,000 women, some of them raped up to 16 times a day just to get them pregnant so that their gene pool would be broken. And some of them have to still face their rapists every day in the villages where they live because these guys never even got on any kind of indictment list for The Hague. So the Reckoning Project, Peter Pomerantsev, my partner, who's an expert in Russian disinformation, and Natalia Gumenyuk, who is a famous Ukrainian journalist, the three of us decided that we weren't going to wait for the ICC or for investigators to start working. We decided to start working immediately on the ground, documenting the atrocities in real time, so that by the time the courts are ready for these cases, we will have all of the evidence. And we can say, we're watching, we see you, and you're not going to get away with it, not this time. So in many ways, I couldn't have done this job when I started out because I needed the kind of 35 years of experience of working in war zones. Heidi and I met during the first Intifada in Israel. The kind of gathering of the experience that I have from being on the ground has led me to be able to take a team of 15 Ukrainian journalists, train them to be human rights monitors, basically. And we have templates, we're in the field throughout the country of Ukraine, and we interview witnesses, then we verify it using many different sources, and then we build cases.
So how do you recruit these people? I mean, are they reporters that you know? Are they people that you sort of find and train? And how do you do that in the middle of the bloodshed?
It's been so interesting. So Natalia, who runs a journalism lab in Ukraine, recruited 15 local reporters. And so this is the really interesting thing. I have huge respect for Human Rights Watch and Amnesty and other groups, but they're foreigners that go in and out. And our team are Ukrainians. So it empowers them to be reporting on their own country or documenting the atrocities. They're local journalists, and so they know they're from the village. Everyone knows them. Everyone trusts them. So they're able to basically record these atrocities, and people trust them. How we train them? We use very rigorous methods, we're having another training next week. Every 6 months, we bring them in from all over Ukraine to Kyiv. This time, actually, we're going outside of Kyiv because of the electricity situation. And we give them training in interviewing techniques for instance, I never knew this in all my years of being a reporter. You cannot interview traumatized people and have it stand up in court. There may be some of you who are lawyers here and you did know this. You cannot go to a traumatized person, get evidence from them, a prosecutor will throw it out. So they have to relearn and not think like journalists, but think like lawyers. And they're trained in international humanitarian law. We try to do a lot of trauma training with them because, of course, they are living in the midst of it for 24/7. Mm. So I'm really proud of my team, but I'm the director, and I'm guiding them and I'm leading them. And they look to me kind of like a mother because I've been through so many wars. So I will tell them, we lived through the siege of Sarajevo. It was 3 years. There was no water. There was no electricity. And we survived. And you can too. You will get through this. But they're a remarkable group of people. And I just have one more thing to say. Most of them are women. Mm-hmm. Because we had men who were mobilized to the front. So we're a group of very strong Ukrainian women and two Syrians who also know very well what injustice means.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's extraordinary work. I mean, so Heidi, obviously, as a great photojournalist, your challenge is to get very close, to the action. I mean, it's very dangerous. And if you don't get that image, there's nothing, right? So you have to get as close as you can. So how does photographing this war in Ukraine compare to the other conflicts? I mean, you've covered wars in Syria and Lebanon, for instance. What are the particular sort of challenges you've been facing in doing the remarkable photographs that you have from Ukraine?
Well, thank you. First of all, I would like to thank everyone for having me and all the people I have met since the beginning of the war that have let me into their lives to try to tell their story. I've had incredible support. Covering the war in Ukraine has been very challenging. It's very dangerous. There are lots of journalists who have been killed. Wearing a press badge does not make you safer, in fact. Many journalists are targeted. We stopped actually even putting media signs on our cars because we were targeted. In this war, I would say it is the first war that I have seen a whole society come together to work together to fight, to win, hopefully win this war. There's no doubt in anyone's mind in Ukraine that they will win this war. I have seen elderly women and young kids working together to cook food for the troops, to provide for the people that are staying in shelter. I've met volunteers who are risking their lives, coming under fire to take elderly people out of their homes to evacuate them. They're particularly very vulnerable.
I'd like to actually call up some of these pictures, if we may, because some of the ones that we have here to show bear out what you're saying. You've done particularly moving work, I feel, on the elderly, actually, who frequently get forgotten in these situations.
In this image, I took in eastern Ukraine in Pokrovsk, which is a hub, an evacuation hub. And I was with the Washington Post team and Siobhan O'Grady, and we met, actually, these three women that were in the back of a van. There are also other patients. So basically, let me just go backwards. What happens every day, there's an evacuation train that leaves at 4:30 in the afternoon. But by 3 o'clock, the volunteers that have risked their lives to evacuate people gather at the train station. It took about an hour before these women were actually carried in the blankets and boarded onto the train. These three women are all wearing red bracelets. They had been, and most of the time were holding on to each other. One of the women, his leg was amputated from diabetes. Some of the women couldn't speak. One of the women actually had a note with her phone number. They did not know where they were going, and which is really heartbreaking.
So it really, really is. Let's just run through these images
in
now.
The next image.
Go to the next image, yeah.
This is taken in the beginning of March, just a few weeks into the war, and thousands of people were crossing the Irpin Bridge, which was just partly destroyed. Nobody could drive over it. this woman, an elderly woman, was covered in snow. It was freezing. She's being transported in a shopping cart. Within those 2 days, we interviewed over 20 people, conducted 20 interviews, and people told us that they were outside their homes. There were landmines. The Russians had controlled 20% to 30% of the city at the time. When I did get into Irpin and cross the bridge, I saw dead elderly people, other people who had been killed, laying on the street, laying in parks. We met people that were taking shelter in the basement. They didn't have any food or electricity. On top of the bridge, I saw a man that had been killed.
So let's go to the next one here and just try to get through these amazing images.
So this is also an elderly man being carried by volunteers. And I have to say, this was so heartbreaking that I was actually having nightmares after visiting and documenting. It was so shocking to see people carrying whatever they could only carry. You had elderly crossing, you had women and children and disabled on crutches, in wheelchairs. At times there were missile strikes that actually killed a whole family not very far away from this location. It's just so unbelievable that this is happening in 2022.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next picture. Oh, I think this picture is one of my, this is the most moving. I mean, the fact that those red roses on the bed, pick up the color on her sweater is something so beautiful and tragic about this picture.
Well, her name is Adea, and I photographed her in Slovyansk in eastern Ukraine. And it was just hours after the Russians had targeted her residential neighborhood. The rockets explode right outside on the street, leaving a huge crater. She was standing next to a pool of blood from a soldier. Several soldiers had rented the room of her apartment a few days earlier because they were on leave from the front line. And she heard them screaming and witnessed them trying to save the life of one of the soldiers. Three other women were killed in that building. In fact, in one of the apartments, there was a woman, elderly woman, who had been just blown to pieces in her bedroom. This is an apartment complex of 150 units. We went back and did a very in-depth story about the people living in this building, and there are only 9 people still living there.
It's incredibly powerful. Sevgil, when you look at these images, I mean, you have all these reporters out on the ground reporting on this horror. How do you sort of administer to these people? Because, I mean, they are witnessing such painful stuff that, I mean, they must get traumatized themselves. Is it for you a hugely demanding sort of management job to essentially sort of run these reporters who are experiencing so much pain?
Of course, when I saw these pictures, for example, this bridge in Irpin, I have my personal story connected to this bridge because in Irpin was my classmate of at Carvajal Niemann Fellowship, Brent Renaud, who is a brilliant documentarian. He was killed near this bridge, and he came to Ukraine to film a documentary about Ukrainian refugees. So it's also a personal story, and you reflect in your personal way. And of course, it's traumatized because it's not only about, it's covering war in your own country. It's about your relatives. It's about your countrymen. And, when I went to these villages, just after Ukrainian army came to these villages and I spoke to the people, they usually use their even own language. And it's so simple and at the same time so heartbreaking. So it's just the grief in the formaldehyde. Mm-hmm. And you can cry even. You cried after you listened to these recordings you took in those places. And you know, the most interesting thing that I'm thinking about the role of journalism. Of course, it's also, it's not only about covering, it's about empathy. And during the war, it is so important. Because when I went, for example, one of the villages 30 kilometers away from Russian-Ukrainian border, and spoke to the woman, and she told me that the most hardest thing was not even be without food, without water. She cried when she understood that I'm a journalist. She said that the hardest thing was be out of news.
Mm. Yeah.
You don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
You can understand everything. And I remember I received a call from my friend in Mariupol. Mariupol was already occupied. It was the end of February. And he asked me only one question. So there was no connection, internet connection. And he asked only one question. I know that Kyiv is already surrounded, and I was trying to explain. No, it's not truth. How did you know that? It's not a truth. It's not like that. I was trying to explain it, but he didn't believe me. And and you think about the role of journalism, because it's literally when before I heard that information saves lives, it was just okay. Maybe it's not so kind of, but.
Yeah,
I understand.
You are an essential pillar of their ability to cope because you're giving them the information. But you know, you're busy kind of in the thick of running these reporters and your staff and helping them to be strong. Who keeps you strong? I mean, you know, you are a woman. You know, you're 35. You're, who keeps you strong? Because it must be very, very stressful for you personally.
Of course, my family and my partner is here also. Nick, he came with me this trip, and during this war we had this personal story because he helped Brent and his team, and he was also the part of the story during this Irpin bridge, and it is hard. And when it happened, I can't reach him for 2 hours. I didn't know if he is alive or not. Mm-hmm. It was heartbreaking. And of course, my team, and I'm so proud of my team and my people. And, you know, I feel guilty seeing things now because now they, in this moment, they cover war and they cover missile attack right now, what is happening. Mm-hmm. And I saw, like, my phone blooming with all this breaking news every second, and I feel guilty about that. Grateful. I'm sitting here in D.C. and my team in Kyiv.
Janine, what is your hardest thing to deal with in this work, because I mean, you are having to also keep this team motivated while also experiencing hideous sights and sounds and stories. How does it impact on you?
It doesn't get easier. The interesting thing is, I thought after all these years, I've seen so much. I've seen so much murder, so many mass graves. I've interviewed so many mothers whose children were murdered in front of them. And I thought by this stage in my life, I'd be able to take it more.
Yeah.
But as Heidi said, I still have nightmares. I still am gripped by anger, bitterness, but mainly sorrow. This is my third Putin war. And I was in Grozny, Chechnya, when it fell to Russian forces in January 2000. That was the moment I thought I'd die. You know, I was one of the only Westerners in the whole country, and the Russians were closing in and with tanks, and I couldn't get out. And I thought, okay, this is it. You know, I'm going to die, but at least I'm going to die believing in something. And something that I have done something. I actually had managed to file my story to the Times of London. It just said, Grozny falls to Russian forces. And then my satellite phone died. But I got my story out. And my second Putin war was Syria, where I spent 8 years. And when Aleppo fell in December 2016, I cried and I cried because I felt like I personally had failed. And I know that sounds egotistical, but I felt that journalism, part of our job, the most noble part of it, is not just to bear witness, which is, of course, hugely important, but to make a difference and to somehow affect policy. So Ukraine's my third Putin war, and I really feel like we're doing it now, you know? I feel like this, the world is galvanized in some ways. I'm very sad that we're not looking at Yemen and Afghanistan and Iran and other places. We will be today. But that there is so much focus on Ukraine, and there should be, because the Ukrainians are fighting for us, for democracy, basically. They're doing the heavy lifting against Putin, who is a disruptor of all democracy. But how do I protect myself? I think writing, and I think the knowledge that somehow we are giving a voice to people that would not have a voice, really matters to me. And, you know, it's written in the Torah that if you save one life, you save humanity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I often, in my darkest moments, and believe me, I have many, when I really feel like I just can't go on anymore, I just can't keep doing this, I think of that.
Mm-hmm. Heidi, just to, before we close, I just wanted to ask you, like, do you ever think about stopping? You know, I mean, you've done so much work over so many years, and I mean, do you sometimes feel...
No. I guess I'm guilty of having an addiction for wanting to make a difference. And actually, the more I do this, the more committed I feel to do that. And I have seen that my images, you know, with baby steps, have helped to make a difference. People have reached out to me asking, how can they help? How can they donate? We did a story about a woman who had walked the streets of Kyiv for days looking for insulin for her son. An NGO in France saw the story, wrote to me on Instagram, asked for the contact number. In the beginning, the woman didn't want to leave. But then a few months later, they sent me a photograph and the child and mother in France.
That's incredibly gratifying for you. You know, Seville, last word to you. What can everyone else in this room say to you in terms of sustaining you in your work?
You know, I was thinking about the role of democracy, and Janine mentioned it before. And, you know, in like free societies, democracy, freedom, press, independent press is taken for granted, like bread, water. And it is normal, like just. But I saw it like it was before March 2022, when I saw pictures from bombed out Mariupol, and then when I saw people who were trying to bake the bread in the ruins of their homes, and they're trying to melt snow to have at least like some drinking water. And it's about the price of democracy during this time and those challenging times. And we keep fighting, so in no way we don't have a chance to lose this war. I mentioned it before, and I will repeat it more often. And that's why, of course, we are exhausted. Of course, we are tired. Of course, we are traumatized. But we have a big hope.
Well, that's incredibly brave. And I really want to thank you all. For each of you, each of your work, each of these women is doing the most remarkable and indispensable work, and we thank you all so much for doing so.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find more conversations from our Global Women's Summit by searching Washington Post Live wherever you listen. Visit WashingtonPostLive.com to register for upcoming programs.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.